I'm Jim Haskell, Senior Portfolio Strategist. We have been examining many aspects of the COVID-19 pandemic with a focus on the massive hits to incomes and asset markets that have led to the most severe economic contraction since the Great Depression. While the data is going to be difficult to interpret in the short run, policymakers around the world will continue responding with coordinated fiscal and monetary measures that are unprecedented in size and scope. But the questions remain, will it be enough? And that will depend on many different answers. What will the path of the virus be? What will the impact of business reopenings be? And if you add into that mix increasing social unrest on a national scale, it certainly looks like uncertainty will reign supreme. Today, I sit down with co-CIO Greg Jensen to talk about our global outlook, the challenges policymakers face in the environment, and the prospects for either deflation or inflation. Greg, welcome.
Thanks, Jim.
The economic shock has been an income shock, not a credit shock. What unique challenges does that present for policymakers in trying to deal with the economic fallout?
Yeah, well, we could discuss what we're seeing as the challenges, but the first thing is to recognize that this is a rare set of circumstances. So there'll be difficult to predict problems that pop up because downturns typically occur through credit, not through income. That generally speaking, most of the recessions that have happened over the last 50 years have been due to central bank tightening because they were concerned about inflation, cutting off credit that then led to a weakening in income. And this time is different because it's a direct fall in income. So the income started falling first when the virus was spreading and lockdown started to occur. It was actually the largest and fastest collapse in income and spending that we've seen. And of course, when one person loses their income because their store is shut, they stop their spending and that's somebody else's income. And that creates a spiral. And this also means that there's a collapse in supply simultaneous to the collapse in demand. That's not normal. When you have a collapse in credit, there's not necessarily as much of a collapse in supply. So it is a different kind of thing to try to make up income than it is to make up credit. Because if you go through the financial collapse, huge loss in credit. That's having a huge impact on the economy. But it was actually relatively easy for central banks to step in and deal with that problem because the central bank itself is a bank. So it could easily take on credit and do the function of a bank. Now, central banks had to take extreme steps relative to their history in the financial crisis. But most of those steps were to print money and replace the credit system. And they were able to do that. Now they're printing money essentially to fund an income hole, which means printing money to make up for the lost work, for the waitress that's out of business, et cetera. Those things are much more indirect and less clear how the Fed stepping in through the fiscal authority will work itself out in terms of, does that translate into some bad outcomes?
Tell us more, if you would, about how you view the hole in incomes or the real economy and what might happen going forward.
Sure, Jim. So first off, our ability to see the hole due to the shutdowns and the lost spending is built upon the understanding that we've built over the last couple of years on our economy bottom to top efforts. So we've mapped our macro understanding down to micro, company by company, household by household, who's doing what and what that means to their balance sheet and their income statements. And so as we watch the hits in different sectors occur in terms of shutdowns and other things, we were able to estimate how much revenue was lost as the first shock was really to corporations. And across the world, we think that was about $27 trillion hit to corporate revenues due to the shutdowns and the coronavirus, and something like a $6.8 trillion hit to profits. Now, the $27 trillion hit then led to a series of other actions by corporates as they tried to fill that hole, which included firing people, which included cutting their intermediate spending, cutting their CapEx, cutting their purchases of financial assets and equity buybacks and M&A, many of which are still to come. And then the fiscal authorities across the world tried to step in and to different degrees mitigate that hole through fiscal policy by getting cash to households and getting some cash to corporations. But a big part of that hole sits on corporate balance sheets going forward, and it still hasn't been fully reconciled.
So let's turn now to the hole in financial markets. And I guess the first question here would be, what hole in financial markets? Financial markets have largely retraced back to where they were prior to the pandemic, at least in many of these markets. So what exactly do you mean by this?
Yeah, well, you're right that there was a hole, but it was actually the easier hole for policymakers to fill. Financial markets were being brought down by the real economic hole. When before the Fed stepped in to do whatever it took to get to this point, the hit to the underlying economy was creating forced selling in the markets because people had lost income and yet had fixed expenses. So there was forced selling in the economy. And when revenues collapsed as fast as they did, you had a tremendous amount of that and certainly didn't have any buying. And that was creating its own problems. The Federal Reserve policy put an end to that. It printed more money, basically at a rate of 100% of GDP in the beginning, to offset the needed selling. And they succeeded in more than offsetting that needed selling. They succeeded in bringing credit spreads down, in bringing basically asset prices back to the levels that they were before. If you take in aggregate stocks and bonds and everything kind of an all-weather framework, all assets sort of back to where they were before this all started, which is a pretty amazing feat that came from this huge printing of money and the money that spiraled out. Now they've gotten those credit spreads down. They filled that hole. What comes next is a bigger question, although we think this is the new paradigm, that they will use quantitative easing to fill that hole in financial markets with the risk of having financial markets diverge from the real economy.
I want to ask you about how effective you think this will be. We've talked before about how the pandemic accelerated the move to the new paradigm. No longer can we just use interest rates, what we call MP1. No longer can we just use quantitative easing, MP2. And so we're now in this quasi-joint venture where central banks are financing fiscal expansions. So, Greg, how effective do you think this kind of monetary fiscal cooperation will be?
Well, we think this is the necessary policy. Now, it's different. So if you go through each one of those, monetary policy one was very effective. When they lowered interest rates, it changed the incentive to borrow and save, and generally affected borrowers by lowering the interest rate, allowing for purchases on credit at lower cost. And that generally worked. If you take how successful the Fed was in managing the economy from the 1980s through today, it's been through lowering interest rates, increasing debts, but having less debt service as a result of the lower interest rates. And with very modest increases in interest rates, they were able to slow down the economy each time it started to overheat. Now that path reached its limit when interest rates got to zero. And you move to a quantitative easing path. Now, quantitative easing is less effective than interest rate cuts because instead of going to borrowers, it's going to savers and hitting savers by trying to squeeze them out of financial markets. And it takes a lot to squeeze savers out of financial markets. You have to drive interest rates down, drive up equity prices. They did that. Eventually, they got some of that money to trickle into the real economy, but the impact on wealth and the wealthy was much higher than the impact on the real economy. So it was inefficient in that way and took large moves in asset markets to create small moves in the real economy. Now, the good thing about monetary policy three is it turns that on its head, that if you use monetary policy to fund bigger and bigger fiscal deficits, which is the direction we think we're headed, the fiscal deficits very directly affect the real economy. And if the monetary policy is coordinated to be about the quantity of the fiscal deficits or less, then that will just, it won't have the same impact on financial markets, it'll have a big impact on the real economy, but that money will get absorbed in the issuance of the bonds. Looking backwards, there was a lot more of the QE than there was of the fiscal. They were running QE at 100% of GDP day. And while there was huge fiscal, it wasn't as much as the monetary policy. But going forward, now the QE has dropped and the fiscal policy and the borrowing associated with the fiscal policy is coming. And so that's the that going forward, you're going to see it more matched. And we think that'll have more impact on the real economy, which desperately needs it, but less impact on the financial economy.
You talk a lot about how this gap between financial asset pricing and the underlying economy needs to ultimately be reconciled. And it brings to mind a question. Why can't central banks just keep printing indefinitely and buying assets to support markets? What brings this to an end? And how should investors think about the risks associated with that reconciliation?
Yeah, well, the first thing is that just to recognize that any wealth, whether it's debt that somebody owes you or equity valuation, is a draw on somebody's future income. Somebody has to pay you back for the debt. Or in the case of being a shareholder in a stock, somebody's got to generate the profits for you to get your percentage of those profits. So all wealth is a draw on somebody's future income. And so you can't get them too far out of line or else the incomes can't pay on the wealth. Now, what the Fed, and the Fed can't change the physics of that, but what they can do is drive asset prices up so that they're dislocated. And if they want to keep asset prices at those levels when the incomes don't accept them, they have to keep printing enough money to create the inflation to bring them in line. Because otherwise, the assets can't stay there. The assets can't stay at a value for which the forward incomes can't essentially pay their value. So you end up with a situation of this reconciliation of the whole, either coming from them converging, where essentially financial markets decline to be in line with future incomes, or it's dealt with in an inflationary way where the incomes are drawn up to the asset prices through higher inflation. So one of those things is going to have to happen to reconcile the wealth levels with the income levels.
Can you say a little bit more about the limits of MP3? Is there a point at which the money printing has to stop?
Right. Well, I just say it this way, that the MP3, essentially, how long can you create income, i.e. either fiscal transfers or doing government projects out of printed money? How far can you push that? And what's going to ever stop it? And there's two ways to look at it. The conceptual way I just described, which is, well, if they drive up asset prices and they get independent, separated from the incomes, that has to get reconciled somehow. Or a second way is just more simply from a policymaking standpoint, when do you ever stop? Why not just print more money and do more good stuff for the economy? And the reason is eventually you hit that wall where it becomes obviously inflationary or have an obvious problem on the currency. And so for us, that's really what we're watching out for. We think across countries, there's this attempt to do this policy. And in some countries that have less ability to get people to save in their currencies and have bigger holes, they'll probably hit those walls sooner. And you'll see problems along the lines of inflation and currency problems. And but eventually, we think the U.S. is pushing in that direction. And the likely thing to stop it is inflation and currency problems. And so that's where we think we're headed.
So that brings me to my next question, Greg, which is around the limitations of particular countries, as you mentioned. Usually, if capital doesn't come into the emerging markets, for example, because they have more constraints, currencies will fall and that will create inflation. But here you're saying the constraints of emerging markets may not create the same type of inflation that we might see, for example, in the U.S. because of the magnitude of how much the U.S. is doing. Can you just explain these dynamics a little bit more?
Yeah, sure. So when you think through the pressures on an emerging market, you want to think through what are their domestic pressures and what are their balance payments pressures. All emerging markets are suffering massive domestic dislocation, just as most of the developed world is. The virus has hit those economies extremely hard, and now they have difficult choices. Because if they want to fill that, if they want to essentially spend higher than their incomes through borrowing, where are they going to get the money from? Do they have the money domestically in order to fund that, or do they have to bring it in externally? So they're generally more limited in their response, because they can't raise as much money as quickly as let's say the Fed and the Treasury does. And so their response to the economic hit is more modest. They are benefiting from the fact that the Fed is pushing out so much money and some of that's flowing into those economies. And they're benefiting from the fact that compared to most of the history, they're less dependent on foreign capital and have more developed credit markets internally. So they have a little bit more ability to deal with this crisis than they might have had in the past. But nonetheless, you're seeing big differences in the degree. You're seeing some countries, let's say Brazil, that we think are really going to test the barriers, where they are doing a lot of fiscal, and they're down the path, at least they're attempting to be down the path of quantitative easing to do that fiscal. Many other countries, like Russia or Mexico or whatever, are taking much more of the hit in their incomes without those huge policies. They're going to have huge recessions and all of the potential conflicts and problems of those recessions, but they don't look nearly as exposed to balance of payments type problems because they're absorbing it in terms of lower income and lower spending. So looking across those countries, you're seeing different attempts to handle the policies differently, and you're likely to see different effects of that in their currency and asset markets.
no matter which country we're looking at, if MP3 did start to generate unacceptable outcomes, what stops the policymakers from just pulling back a bit to alleviate those?
Well, I think that this is where it's going to get very difficult, and the risk of stagflation is probably the biggest risk we face, because it's before the policymakers achieve their goals that they end up facing these. Then they get stopped in the way of getting to their goals. And this will be a dynamic moment for markets, in my view, because right now, a lot of the market pricing is kind of on the assumption that the Fed can get what it wants. And to be clear, the Fed has been. They wanted credit spreads to come down to a certain level. That pretty much happened. They wanted mortgage spreads to come to a certain level. That pretty much happened. The Fed's pretty much getting whatever it wants in markets. And the markets are pretty much accepting that the Fed can get what it wants. Australia's central bank says they want the three-year rate at a certain rate. Boom, they get what they want. That's not always true. What's the constraint on central banks getting what they want? And that constraint is the currency and inflation. And so if you start to see that inflationary result before central banks and policymakers have achieved their goals, i.e. let's say before they bring unemployment rates down significantly, that's going to put them in a terrible bind, because it's going to become clear to the markets they can't necessarily get what they want. They're going to have to choose between inflation and acceptable unemployment rates. And then both markets will face that risk of, well, what will they choose and what are the differences? And policymakers, probably across the board, will do different things under those conditions. What will you do if you have a 10% unemployment rate and inflation hits 4 or 5%? This is also how it worked in the 60s and 70s. It's easy to look back and say, boy, how reckless that policy was. They let inflation spiral. But in many of those trade-offs, they faced the trade-off between quite weak economic conditions and higher inflation, and raising real rates to offset that was a very problematic policy position. I think you'll see that here, where people are forced to choose that. And we think countries, let's say the UK, is a particularly interesting test case in my mind, because they're really being aggressive, a lot of fiscal, a tremendous amount of monetary. They don't have quite the same reserve currency status as the US, although it's somewhat of a reserve currency. So we think that's the kind of country that might see these thresholds threatened earlier. And so worth watching how that plays out.
In terms of the inflation risk, we've described the magnitude of the economic downturn as catastrophic. And although we may have reached the bottom, unemployment is likely to remain very high and demand depressed. All of that seems deflationary. And yet you're talking about having all of that and also stubbornly high inflation. Can you walk us through the first order effects, but then the second order effects, and ultimately what results? Because it's very confusing to investors who have been used to deflationary pressures for some time now.
Yeah, I think that's a great question, Jim, because like you said, everybody's so used to deflationary pressures for the last 35, 40 years that it's a wind at the back of financial markets, that it's easy to forget what caused the wind and how would you know if it's changing, right? So when you look backwards, what caused the decline in inflation from 1980, you know, the early 80s through today? That A, there was a transition, Volcker-led transition in monetary policy to fight inflation, point one. Point two is, with that, you also had a huge degree of globalization that allowed lower labor costs to be taken advantage of all over the world. You also had a massive boom, particularly in the second half of that, in technology that was very deflationary. And through that period, you built up debts, and debts themselves are calls on future income that are deflationary. So all of those things, that's kind of the backdrop of the things that were causing the big deflationary waves. Now, many of them have already turned. The deflationary part of globalization, I would say, is probably plateaued at best and potentially worsening, where it had been a deflationary wave. Now you see all the challenges with supply chains and the movement from sort of the most efficient possible supply chains to more resilient supply chains, and the movement away from globalization and the risk of tariffs that already have started but could become a bigger part of the global economy. So the deflationary impact of globalization is certainly at risk. The central banking decision to keep high real interest rates to drive inflation down has certainly flipped. The view among central bankers that inflation is even mainly a cyclical phenomenon is not really there. That when we come to is this slowdown going to cause a fall in deflation, it's worth thinking about the 10-year improvement in the economy over the last 10 years and why that didn't cause much of an increase in inflation. So it's not so much the cycle that's driving it. It's these big things, globalization, the view, the central bank policy, fiscal policy, and then the movement in technology. Now, the only thing that really stands out as continuing to be deflationary is the technology story that continues on. Now, we do think there's some risk in terms of regulations and things like that that might prevent that to be as deflationary, but that's certainly there. But the rest of the ingredients have turned. And when you take a policy like monetary policy 3, which is about creating money to create demand without itself creating any more supply of the things that were produced before, that's probably an inflationary shift. And that eventually, if you do enough of that policy, that you create demand without a corresponding creation in supply, that you'll run that through.
You know, right after the global financial crisis, there was a lot of sentiment that the amount of quantitative easing would also lead to inflation. And that didn't turn out to be the case. Can you differentiate the current period from then? And why do you feel the design of MP3 will be different than what MP2 was in ultimately driving prices higher?
Yeah, well, during that period, we didn't think so. And really, Ray wrote about the concept of a beautiful deleveraging, which we talked about a lot, which is if you use money to offset credit. So if there's a credit collapse, the credit collapse is deflationary. If the money comes in essentially to offset that credit, it is not inflationary. It's doing the same thing as the credit. It's just replacing the credit. And that's basically what happened in the financial crisis, is the quantitative easing was geared to create enough money to offset the credit, not that much more than that. And that created kind of this maintenance of the deleveraging and stopped the deleveraging from getting worse. And the economy was able to recover at a gradual rate as a result of money replacing credit. This is different. Money replacing income is different because the money creates the same amount of, let's say, household demand, while the loss of the job doesn't get replaced. It's the job is out, there's less supply, but the money is there. Different picture than when you were replacing credit. And so we didn't think that was going to be inflationary then and thought that it was the right way to handle a collapse of credit. Now here, it really depends, to be clear. I don't want to go so far as to say it will necessarily be inflationary. It is just more at risk because you're doing much less of making up for credit and much more of making up for income. And that's a much more risky policy. Now, given the circumstances, it's a risk that's probably worth taking because you're not sure how much technological deflation you can offset with income enhancement through money, but it is certainly a more risky and drawn to its extreme, much more obvious why it'll become an inflationary problem.
I want to ask you one last question about inflation, because the outcomes that you're describing sound to me more like currency debasement, you know, inflation, maybe perhaps some cost push inflation because of the, you know, restricted supply, certainly not demand pull kind of inflation that is a function of a real hot economy. Does any of this matter? Is inflation just inflation, or does it matter what the root cause of that inflation is as it pertains to financial assets and investment?
Well, I'd say monetary inflations are more pernicious than cyclical inflations, because cyclical inflations are relatively easy to deal with in the sense that you just have to slow down the economy to get it in line. Monetary inflation, when you essentially are trying to fill your budget deficit, fill the lack of income with money, that's a pernicious thing that's not easy to get out of, because A, people start to lose faith in the money, the economy gets worse when you need to tighten. So that's a much more difficult type of thing than, let's say, a cost push inflation to deal with, which is what most of the last 40 years of monetary policy was focused on, that type of leaning against cost push inflation. Now you get this type of unacceptable income loss, and the monetary printing is to make up for the unacceptable income loss. Now that type of inflation, particularly if it occurs before the unacceptable income loss is reconciled, is much more dangerous, much more difficult. It's common in the rest of the world. It's less common in the US. And there's reason to believe it will be less bad in the US because there's still so much savings in the dollar to absorb that without a significant problem, which really leads, you know, we won't get into it in this conversation, but we've certainly written a lot about it, which is, okay, well, when do you hit the wall with the reserve currency status of the dollar? Because we're certainly going to stress it. Is one of the huge benefits that allow us these policies. And it's also one of the big risks, because if you lose that reserve status over time, you lose the ability to manage the economy as you have been and start to risk sort of the spiraling of the inflation, hurting your reserve status, making it more inflationary, and making it worse for your economy at the same time. So we'd be on the lookout for that type of movement, which we think we could be near the precipice of.
As you've said many times, there's a wide range of outcomes. If policymakers can't get what they want, we could be looking at deflationary depression. If policymakers do get what they want, the opposite may be true, more like stagflation or an inflationary depression. So my simple question is, what can investors do now to prepare their portfolios?
So just to paint that range for a second, and then I'll get into thoughts on what to do. But there's the one thing, which as we come into election season in the U.S., so much is up in the air, right? And so there's the risk on the deflationary side is the risk that we don't do enough. I think that's the less likely risk, but let's just talk about it for a second, which is you could totally imagine, let's say Biden gets elected and there's a Republican and the Republicans hold the Senate. And you could end up stuck where they actually draw the line on fiscal and Republicans won't pass anything. And all of a sudden, this whole movement to MP3 stalls when you need it the most, because you have the corporate balance sheets in trouble, unemployment rates at high levels, and you're really stuck without a large government reaction. So you could imagine that outcome. And we would think that would kind of worsen the deflation and the Japanification of the U.S. And it'd be a pretty difficult set of circumstances. On the opposite end, and probably more likely, is if either the Democrats sweep or Trump wins again, you get policies to spend more money because you can, and the Fed more or less monetizing that, and you move towards that and pushing those extremes, which again, if that gets pushed towards inflationary before you've resolved the growth problems, which it could, you could end up in a stagflationary kind of cycle exacerbated by foreign investors losing their faith in the dollar. That's a very real scenario as well. Something basically, if you stress test your portfolio for the first scenario through kind of a Japan gradual deflation kind of situation, and you stress test the second, it's something like the 1970s or something like that. And if you're okay with the outcomes in both of those scenarios, we think that's a pretty good stress tested portfolio. And then there's a range in between in the hopeful range, which is that policy's intelligent, it's well calibrated. You take advantage of the deflation to invest a lot in highly productive improvements in the economy, and that allows for us to kind of get out of the growth thing appropriately with the government taking on more debt, but more debt in the form of investment that actually pays off in terms of productivity. Now that's much more difficult, probably more unlikely than the two poles, I'd say, but that's another possibility in terms of how these things are reconciled. Now, what kind of portfolio can you survive that range of events? We start with diversification is probably more important than ever. I think the globe has going from interdependence to independence. So the likelihood of the super high correlation across all global assets probably going to decline the need and the opportunity to globally diversify more important than ever. And it's more difficult to achieve than ever because you've got the challenges across the world, possible capital controls, et cetera. And on environmental balance, you have the problem that nominal bonds are very difficult to essentially help diversify equities. So you need to look for different ways to diversify. We'd say the 60-40 is kind of dead and much riskier than normal because nominal bonds, 40% of it, are going to yield essentially zero. So what do you do with all of this? And this is a huge question, which we'll keep sharing our thoughts on. But a big part of it is looking at what creates balance in a world of monetary policy three. What's going to happen if there's a downturn that drives the equity market lower? Our view would be probably the thing you'd most expect. In the old world, you'd expect interest rates to decline, and that would help bonds. In the new world, you'd expect monetary policy to get more extreme in terms of printing money and fiscal policy to get more extreme. So if you can take the assets that'll do okay if monetary policy prints more money and fiscal policy gets more expansive, what are those assets to offset a decline in the equity market? I think looking at IO bonds and gold and creating your balance out of those, probably better than nominal bonds, and you can create still a pretty good balanced portfolio, probably some commodities as well. So we think that movement is important. Sort of smaller moves to consider are making sure you're in nominal bonds that have yields that could still fall. Looking at China, for nominal bond exposure, as an example, it's pretty much undertapped by most global investors. The bond market itself is operating pretty normally. I.e., when stocks in China go down, the bonds tend to rally. When growth goes down, the bonds tend to rally. So bonds create a diversification in China in a way that's much more of a struggle in much of the developed world. So looking at other countries, both for global diversification purposes and also to get assets that could do okay if stocks do poorly, that's another big part of what we would be thinking about.
Greg, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Jim.